Hello. In this audio snippet, we would like to take the opportunity to talk about a topic that we have been postponing, shall we say, for a while, and we keep saying that we will talk about it, and we haven't been able to get to it. So we'd like to do it in this audio snippet. So we're breaking off from the routine, shall we say, or the pattern of time between between recordings, and so this is going to be shared today, which happens to be the 4th of July of 2023, and as we shared in the previous recording, this is the last 4th of July that America will celebrate. Yes, there will be other 4th of Julys later on, but they will be with an America that is dead. There will be no America, no destiny, no promise of anything. We will be a third world country in less than, or shall we say, within a period of 2 to 3 months. So this is the last day of independence. There was a birth that happened on the 4th of July, 1776, of a nation that had a promise. Imperfect as it was, it had this great potential, and it did achieve a lot of things, but it never really reached the greatness it was called to achieve. So that is 247 years, if I'm not mistaken, from 1776 to 2023. So we didn't even make it to, or sorry, I think I'm doing my numbers wrong. Yes, it is 247. So we didn't even make it to 250. So we didn't make it to a quarter of a millennium, shall we say, or a century. I apologize. Oh yeah, well, a millennium. Yeah, a millennium. A quarter of a millennium. So we'd like to talk about the election of 1876, which happened 100 years from 1776, more or less. But before we get it into that, we would like to share some minor things that kind of are spilling over from previous recordings. For one, I failed to mention something that I wanted to mention in the past recording about a man named John Darby. We had mentioned him two recordings ago, but for some reason, when I was recording, I kept saying John Noble Darby, John Noble Darby, and then I then began to wonder what was his middle name. So when I verified, it was really John Nelson Darby, and I said to myself, why did I do that? And I wasn't sure what happened in my brain that made the switch from John Nelson to John Noble Darby. And as I thought about it, it kind of made sense, not to, justify the mistake, but it seems like the mistake had a purpose for some reason. Because Nelson is a name that comes from son of Neil, according to BehindTheName.com and other websites, and the name Neil has kind of a disputed origin, so it's not clear exactly where Neil came from. So, but there are two or three theories, and the two more plausible ones, or the ones that seem more likely, are one that says that it comes from a word, and they're both. The origin is definitely Irish Celtic, And one of the possible origins of the name is an old Irish word that means fury or passion. And then the other strong possibility is hero, from another old Irish word that means hero. So in both cases, fury or passion or hero give the connotation of a person with a fervor, with a passion, literally, who is willing to fight and show emotion for a cause or something that they believe in. So it means that it refers to people who are not just sitting idly by and letting things happen. They are heroes. They are people who show passion about things and who show a fury, a drive to change things. And that's why it's interesting. I noticed when I was looking into the meaning of that name that, you know, for example, on behindthename.com, they mention, they always mention the name of a famous person who was born the name being described. And the person they described for, or they mentioned for Neil, the name Neil is Neil Armstrong. And as you know, he's the first man, an American, by the way, who the first human to step on the moon. And I know that some people don't believe that we made it to the moon, but for reasons that are too long to explain and too long for me to remember, a lot of the theories out there that say that it was all staged are not valid. And yes, they raise some interesting points, but all the points have an explanation and a justification. And having had such a big event that would have required so many people being in on it, and all of them hushing up and not saying anything is more unbelievable than believing that that we made it to the moon. Even though, you know, some people who like conspiracies might find that idea very tasty, like, oh, another nice little conspiracy to hold on to. But I personally do believe that we made it to the moon. Amazing as it was, in such a short span of time and with the limited technology that was available, at least compared to now. But the thing is, and the reason why mentioning Neil Armstrong is that it kind of certifies that idea that the name Neil was associated with boldly going where no man has gone before, to quote a certain television show, to not stay in the comfort zone and venturing out into new things that require a commitment and a passion. So that's kind of what the name Nelson more or less conveys. And then when I thought about the word, the name noble, I said, well, noble, I said, what does that mean? My first thought was, you know, somebody who's noble, who's generous, who's kind, who has a good heart kind of thing. But the more I thought about it, is that no, noble, and I felt this like confirmation as I thought about that, that noble more or less refer to nobility. You know, people who are at this higher echelon of existence, who are not so concerned about daily events because, you know, they're part of the nobility. They're more worried about their next polo match or the next fox hunting expedition or the next round of golf they will play and so forth. So it just speaks of a certain level of elitism and kind of isolating yourself from the mundane things, or living at this ivory tower or this special place where you don't worry about what the little people are thinking about. And I said, oh, that makes sense. So, not to justify the mistake, but it seems like there was an actual justification for my inadvertent change of the name. And the reason is that this man, we won't talk about it in this recording to avoid digressing too much, but John Nelson Darby is responsible for, or has a great deal of responsibility for what, for the current state of the American conservative church, or the American Christian church. Even though most people wouldn't recognize his name, even people who go to church every Sunday, American Christians or any Christian around the world, most of them would not know who he was. But his thinking had a strong influence on the thinking of Christians, especially here in America. And because it made such an impact in America, it automatically transferred to the Christian, quote, Christian thinking around the world, because that's how we've been. As America goes, the rest of the world goes. That's how influential we became. And it's all ending this year. And that's why we had such a great responsibility. That's why the truth, in a sense, was waiting for us to respond to the truth and to act out truth at a higher level, not at the mediocre level that we've been in for 247 years. But we just kept saying no, 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 and our time ran out. It's running out. It's still officially ticking, but it's done. I have no expectation of anything happening that will change things. It's just as I've said a million times, it's like an American football game where the score is 72-0. You know, we're and in the fourth quarter, the 2-minute warning has been issued. And only a fool would, with the expectation of, oh yeah, maybe we can make a comeback and score 72 points in the last 2 minutes. So that's kind of how I see it. So it's almost, it's all but said and done, even though the game is not yet officially over. But the thing is that, this John Noble Darby had this influence on America, on the American church, even though he was Scottish, if I remember correctly. He had this great influence across the pond. And he changed the dynamic of American Christian thinking with his ideas. And many people who believe certain things about the rapture and all these other things, anti-eschatology, what they call it in Christian circles, you know, these ideas of what will happen in the end times and all this stuff. A lot of those things, people think that they came from like 2,000 years ago, from the age of the disciples and the early primitive church in the Middle East and so forth. But it's not really the case. If you go back to 1776, and ask an American Christian, what they think about the end times and all that, you would be surprised at what they would have said, because it would have sounded absolutely nothing like what American Christians believe today. Especially, all these preachers who act like they are these experts on end time prophecy or whatever, as they call it, like John Hagee and other people who think that they know exactly how things will be and that they understand, what the prophecies in the Bible are about and all that stuff. So all of that thinking that American Christians take as like standard truth was kind of created by John Noble Darby, and I could be wrong, but I remember him being from the 19th century. I do believe he was from the 19th century. So these ideas are relatively new, shall we say, compared to the age of the whole church, a Christian church. But the fact that they're new doesn't make them wrong. It's just that it's just to emphasize that people who think that these things are true because they've been believed for hundreds of years, and it's just a continuation of a tradition. You know, these people who love tradition and who worship tradition don't realize that these things that they believe in are really not that old. And if they knew it, they would be a little shocked. And the thing is that that thinking that came in the mid to late 1800s, when it jumped the pond and came to America, transformed the thinking of American Christians from being Christians who, if you look at for example, the pre-Civil War period in America, all the people who were working to end slavery, who were speaking out, boldly speaking out against it, the people who participated in the Underground Railroad, who did all these things, I would dare say that the significant, if not overwhelming, majority of them were devout Christians. So people who believed in changing things. And a lot of the people who believed it, who endeavored to get women, give women the right to vote and all these things, who fought for women's rights, as they call them now, a lot of them, if not most of them, were strongly devout Christians, not just, you know, church-going Christians with a nominal quote Christianity, you know, like people who say, oh, I'm Catholic, but they don't go to Mass or anything like that. Or, you know, people who say, I am a Buddhist or whatever, and wouldn't recognize a Buddha statue if it hit them in the face. So these were not nominal religious people. They were, you know, people who were devoutly, who were devoted to their understanding of Christianity, and who saw it as a continuation of their faith, of their belief. It wasn't like, oh, they had their religion here, and then they had these social causes on the other hand, on the other side. They were all part of the same thing. So, and that was the thinking. So in other words, people who were fighting for rights and things like that were the Christians, the devout, zealous Christians in America. And that all changed as the thinking from John Noble Darby came in. Again, I'm calling him John Noble Darby, but his literal name was John Nelson Darby. But what he did was basically turn people from Nelsons into Nobles, from people who were driven with this zeal, this divine zeal, this thing, like they felt that they were here on this planet to do something, and they were doing it in the name of their God, and they were fighting these battles. All of that went away, and when the thinking of John Noble or Nelson Darby came, they turned, it's like as if the American church turned into this nobility. These people who were kind of aloof, like, oh, you know, we don't touch that dirty little world down there. You know, we are like spiritual nobility. We're a little bit higher than those heathens who don't believe in God. And we're just sitting up here in this higher echelon of existence, just waiting for the big spaceship to come and beam us up in the rapture to get us all out of here, so that, you know, the world can be consumed and somebody can clean it up for us, and we can come back with the earth all cleaned up, you know, like as if it was, you know, some cleaning crew that they hired to clean up a place. And the cleaning crew, these angels or whatever, will come and clean things up. And then we, you know, the Christians said, we will come back and rule the earth like the nobility that we are. So it is a very kind of elitist thinking. Subtle, but it created this separation from the world, like, oh, the world is here and Christianity or whatever is up here, and the two things don't mix, they're not related. The earth, we're not here to change anything, we're just here waiting. We just have to be, you know, inside the mothership or the capsule, you could say, the mother capsule, waiting for the mothership to beam the mother capsule with everyone in it up you know, to some magical place. And so that's the thinking. That's why Christians began to kind of separate themselves from making changes, and that created this vacuum in the American society. And that's when people of you know, what we call liberals now began to slowly fill that vacuum. And that's why now when a person thinks about, oh, people who fight for civil rights or whatever, they don't think about John Brown and all these other Christians out there, you know, from the past. They don't think about Christians at all. They think about, you know, crazy, loony, left-wing Democrat liberals, because they are the ones who filled that vacuum. And they filled it, and then they used the opportunity to bring in their nonsense. And that's why the country's dying. And it has a lot, so it seems like an unrelated thing to talk about in the context of 1776 and July 4th, but I believe it's very relevant in that sense. And it also is symptomatic of the isolation that the Republican Party began to have from the world. The Republican Party was born out of the desire to give black people freedom and equality in this nation, an equality that was denied to them in 1776. You wouldn't know it now, because the Republican Party is silent about issues in black America. And as we've explained before, being non-silent about black America doesn't mean, oh, fighting for affirmative rights and all this stuff, because that is more destructive than beneficial. It's talking about saying, yeah, we care about what happens in black America, and we need to fix this, so we need to do some things on our end, but black America, you need to do this, and that. As our brothers, we're telling you, you need to do this. And working with them, helping them to achieve, to fix the things that they have broken in their family, because the black, every race is a family, as we've explained a million times. And it's a dysfunctional family. The black family, the black race in America is a dysfunctional family. And the Republicans should be the ones in the forefront of exposing this, that dysfunctionality, and say, hey, we're committed to helping your family to achieve the dream. And we're going to do the things that we need to do on our end, but you have to do your end too, and we can work together and we care for you. But there's nothing, that message is not there. And why? Because the Republican Party is more or less filled, and that's where, or how can we say this? Christian people gravitate towards the Republican Party for natural reasons. But they gravitate towards it, and once they're in it, they bring that nobility thinking. Like, oh, we don't care about the world is going to burn anyway, and I'm just waiting for my hallelujah moment when I'm beamed up into heaven, and nothing that I do or related to this world is relevant. And I don't think they realize the stupidity of their thinking, not only in the short term, but in the long term. And I mean, and when I say long term, I mean long, long term, not just, you know, the next 10 years or anything like that. So I think that's why I, in my head, I kept calling him John Noble Darby, because he turned, the Christians in America into a nobility, instead of being Nelsons, instead of being sons of Neil, you know, being, Neil Armstrongs, who are boldly, you know, challenging, stereotypes, or boldly challenging natural expectations and achieving impossible things, you know, like what happened in 1969 on July 20th, I think it was, when we stepped on the moon for the first time in human history. So we wanted to mention that, and it took a lot longer than I expected, but we needed to clarify that. And the second thing, before we finally get to 1876, is, and I think it's relevant to all of the, this whole thing about the theme in part, you know, July 4th, is this story that happened recently, a few days ago. Donald Trump went down to South Carolina, and it was interesting because South Carolina, is, we talked about it before in the previous recording, as being the place where the balloon, the Chinese spy balloon, finished crossing through the U.S., and then it was shot down off the coast of South Carolina, but you know, it had already done its thing, its job, and we spoke about why that was significant. And I don't remember exactly where the diagonal of the 2017 total eclipse ended, but I do believe that it was in South Carolina as well, or somewhere close to that. So the thing is that Trump ended up being in South Carolina. I don't remember if it was before or after the last audio recording, but he went to do a rally there in a small town called Pickens. And it's, I think, a town of 3,000 people or some small number like that. And the big news was how he kind of messed up the town, because people came in from all over the place and they filled, I think it was like a 50,000 people rally in this small town of 3,000 people. So the main street of the town was overflowing with, you know, all these people who came from everywhere. So he had the big rally and all that. But the interesting thing, and I didn't realize this until maybe 2 days ago, I believe it was 2 or 3 days ago, that there was a freak storm, that a powerful 10-minute storm that hit the town where he had been, where Trump had been, 1 hour after he left. So he was there, the rally was held, and then this freak storm that just ravaged the town came in. And the weird thing is that this freak storm only hit two counties in North Carolina, in South Carolina. One is Pickens County, where the town of Pickens is, and the other county was Greenville County. And it was a massive, weird storm that just swept through these two counties. And it did it 1 hour after the rally had ended in Pickens, in the town of Pickens in Pickens County. And it caused this massive destruction. And the weird things that people were commenting was that those were the two counties. So apparently Trump arrived in Greenville County and then traveled, you know, flew from Greenville County to Pickens County and did the rally. So in other words, the two places where he touched down in South Carolina were the two counties, exact counties, where the storm came and wreaked its destruction. Now, you would say, okay, what does that mean? I find it interesting because it's as if the truth was saying, hey, you know, it doesn't matter how much you love or support this guy, there's not going to be a positive thing coming out of this. It's all going to be destruction anyway. And so, because why those two counties in particular, the two counties where Trump set foot, you know, he went from Greenville County, he arrived in South Carolina and touched down at Greenville County, shall we say, and then he traveled to Pickens County. And those two counties were the ones who got hit 1 hour after the rally ended, 1 hour. So you would say, well, if it was meant to be, if Trump is the one who's going to restore the country and blah, 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 and win 2024 and make America great again and all that rubbish, then why would the storm hit in those two places? Wouldn't you think that, you know, if Trump is Christian, wouldn't you think if the Christian God is with him, wouldn't the, like, rainbows have appeared and Pickens County 1 hour after he left, like saying the hope, you know, of this great nation as you rally around this man, you know, God saying, "I will make things good again." You know, and these beautiful rainbows appearing and birds chirping and all being good. No, 1 hour after he left, it was like, this is if, you know, the God that Trump claimed, supposedly believes in, came and said, "This is what I think of this whole rally, this whole thing." And so that was interesting to me. And to me, it's just more confirmation that yes, the country is dead. And by the way, just as a clarification, I've said this before, but when I call Make America Great Again rubbish, I call it rubbish because yes, America is the greatest nation, has been the greatest nation on earth until now. Now it's on its way down, but it has been the greatest nation on earth, probably in many aspects, the greatest nation in human history. But that never made it great. Great in potential, that it always had. It had a greatness to it, but it was a potential that had to be manifested. But to say Make America Great Again is implying America reached its greatness, its destiny. It achieved all it could be. All we need is to get back to that old way of, you know, that old greatness that we had. When the problem is no, the problem is we had the greatness. It's like when you have a great football player, you know, whether it be American football or you know, the actual real football. You see this great football player, let's say it's the actual football, you know, soccer or whatever. You see this great young player who is dazzling when he touches the ball and dribbles and does all these things and makes these incredible shots and all that. You see the potential, you see the kid, but he hasn't really achieved anything. He's just a kid playing at the high school or university level, but he hasn't really made it, you know, to the professional ranks and so forth. And then to see him, you know, wasting his life away doing drugs or just not practicing or not staying in shape or whatever, and your heart breaks seeing that potential die. That's kind of what America is. America never matured into what it needed to be. So to say Make America Great Again is to assume that we already achieved the greatness we were destined for. We just need to get back to that. And that is like a slap in the face of the truth. It's as if to say, hey, you know, we are already great. What are you talking about that we had to do something else to complete our journey? No, we already made it to the promised land. This was it. And we were on the other side of the Jordan the whole time. The promised land was on the other side. And we stopped short of the Jordan thinking, hey, we've made it. And now we're receding, and we just need to go back to where we were before. No, we're dying because we never crossed the Jordan. That created a vacuum, and it got filled by the enemy. You know, and now liberals are running rampant, destroying the country, and conservatives complain, bitch, and moan about the destruction. They don't realize they are the ones responsible for that destruction, because they created the vacuum that enabled the infiltration of liberals to take over. And part of that vacuum was enabled by the thinking of John Noble Darby, and I'm going to call him like that, how he transformed the Christian church in America from one, without meaning to, you know, it was like, you know, ideas are very powerful. They can do a lot of destruction or a lot of benefit. So he wasn't thinking about politics or anything like that. He wasn't indoctrinating people into a certain political attitude or whatever. He just had these ideas about, you know, what the Bible said about these things. And those ideas inadvertently led to this deformation of American Christians from being world changers to being world withdrawn or earth withdrawn. I would say more than world withdrawn. I'd use the word earth withdrawn. So basically, the American Christian Church turned into a convent or a monastery, where people just went to flock and it's and waiting, you know, for the end of the world, you know, Harold Camping style, just waiting for the end of the world, and well-meaning and all of that, but they left a vacuum on Earth, and the Earth, and that vacuum is being filled, and then that vacuum is affecting them and about to destroy them, because as America dies, the Christian church in America is going to die with it. You know, it's like you can't have Christianity blossoming, for example, in a, let's say in Cuba, or you know, places where there's great oppression, then Christianity, especially in the state it's in, has no chance of surviving. You know, because you would think about the Christians of the Roman times, of the you know, the primitive, what they call the primitive church. These people were suffering great persecution, but there was a zealousness about them. There was a Nelson quality about them that made them unstoppable, to the point that eventually the Roman Empire became a quote Christian empire, and then it got degraded when it became politically acceptable to be a Christian in Roman times. That's when Christianity started degrading and degrading. But what I'm trying to say is that that in an environment where there's absolute persecution and oppression, if you have a church that is all, you know, John Noble Darby instead of being a church of Nelsons, then it's going to die too. So in that convent mentality that American Christians have adopted, they have sealed their own destruction. They cannot exist, and they will perish before the magical rapture spaceship comes in and takes them, quote, home. And that's why we have this vacuum, and that's why we are where we are, and this is why this is the last 4th of July that America will have with, you know, being with it being alive, technically alive. And there have been a few victories that have been happening recently that we've talked about in related to the Supreme Court and some decisions they've made. And this website that was shut down that we talked about, Citizen Free Press, that lost its power because a storm blew through the area where their servers are and all that, and they didn't have power for quite a while. That happened on June 29th. We talked about it in the previous recording. It took them some days to finally get the power back. I think they got it like a day or two ago. And they keep, you know, talking about, you know, the greatest victories. We've had the greatest victories in this week, the greatest victories in 50 years. And I saw this headline on that website, and I said, oh my goodness, you know, living in a bubble, you know, living in this convent where things are magical and there's no contact with reality. I said to myself, 50 years, that goes, I did the arithmetic, oh, that takes us back to 1973, the year before Watergate and Nixon's resignation. Not sure why they said 50 years, but the thing is that so many more relevant victories have happened in those 50 years. So these little Pyrrhic victories, and they are meaningful and they're good and all that, but Pyrrhic in the sense of overcoming what's coming in less than 3 months, that is the end of the country, and to rejoice at these small victories. It's like we're down 72-0 in American football, and our offense finally got a first down after going like two quarters without even getting a first down. And now we had like three first downs in a row. So we've advanced the ball like 30, 40 yards. But we're still way away from scoring a field goal. Maybe we're getting within field goal range, but with the score 72-0, getting into field goal range is nothing to be excited about. And the sad thing is these conservatives don't realize that the few victories that have been achieved. And I said to myself, you know, this week, the greatest victories in 50 years, what about the victory that overturned Roe v. Wade and ended, you know, this free check of abortion that was passed? Isn't that victory greater than the three or four little victories we had this past week? I would say so. But these victories and the victory of overturning Roe v. Wade came what I call a metaphysical currency to pay for these victories that enabled these victories came from people who are the truth seekers, not the conservatives. The conservatives have been complaining about this all the time for years and years and years. And it was the sacrifice and the words and the power that came from the truth seekers in this country, who are not the conservatives, the truth seekers. They're the ones who enabled these victories that we're seeing now, the few victories. But the conservatives will never embrace these truth seekers and say, hey, can you tell us how we can do this and how to get more of these victories? Because to them, it's like, you know, they know what they're doing, and they will not take any advice from these irrelevant people. But these irrelevant people, the truth seekers, have been the ones who enabled these victories for them to enjoy and rejoice over. But because they do not listen to the broader message, they don't want to embrace these truth seekers, because embracing them would mean killing their own ideology, killing their worship of the founding fathers and the Constitution. Because they don't want to do that, then they keep them on the sidelines. So these people, even on the sidelines, the truth seekers, have been able to achieve, to produce the metaphysical currency that has enabled these victories. But they won't even recognize that. So so that's what I wanted to talk about. And the other thing, but we won't get into that this time, but we'll probably mention it in the next audio recording if it's possible. It's like a completely unrelated thing, but for some reason I feel like it ties into everything. I'm not sure exactly how or why, but I have, and I'll make it very short without going into the details until the next recording, I believe. But I'll just make the statement. India is a spiritual enemy. It's a metaphysical enemy. It's like this entity that has surfaced now that the focus has gone from America back to England. And so it's that, you know, 1776 was the day when we broke off from England and said, we are an independent nation and we're going to start a new thing in the world. On this 4th of July, we celebrate that. This is the last time we can celebrate that with any sense of reality to it. But now after America dies a few months from now, what was brought over to here from England is going to return to England, and permanently, forever and ever, and it will be done, and there will be no undoing it. And but now that the focus, that thing has been brought back, taken back to England, and I say England in particular, for some reason I have to say England, not you know Great Britain or the UK. I have to say England. And now that it's returned to England, then now it's as if I began to realize, because of things that started happening, you know, personally, that India is now the big enemy of the change. And I've always said India are Britain's Hispanics. And just like the Hispanic scourge, you know, has tainted America from within, you know, this invasion that we've had of the corruption of Latin America. In the same sense, India has this influence in England. And that's all I'll say about that for now. I feel there's a big enemy there. And another thing I do want to say is that I get irritated when, you know, people, you know, especially Christians, talk about all these missionary things and going to India and helping the people of India and all this and all that. And I go, for crying out loud, you know, you guys have been going out to India for, what, 200 years or 300 years or however many years, going to, quote, evangelize Indians and all that. And look at you know, look at how much change you have wrought. They're still worshiping rats. They're I'm not exaggerating. They have temples where rats are roaming about, and they're the, you know, they don't kill them or anything because they think that they are the ancestors, reincarnations of ancestors. You know, so like a rat maybe going by, that goes, oh, there's Uncle Rajesh, or you know, and things like that. So, and there are places in India where they are they worship snakes. They have all these snakes roaming about. It's gross, and these it's incredible levels of poverty, and they still have leprosy, I think, in India and all that stuff. And people, when you think about people that are so intelligent, you know, when they educate themselves and everything, they're so successful, but they still cling to this stuff and all this Christian missionary stuff. Effort that has been done on India is futile. And I go, you know, what the hell are you doing wasting time on people that don't want to change? You should say the hell with them. You know, if they don't want to change their problems, let them destroy themselves. It's not worth investing on them anymore. And if you're of Indian origin or Pakistani or whatever, or Bangladeshi or Sri Lankan origin or whatever, I'm talking about people as a group. You as an individual, you're your own person, and you can force your own destiny and everything. But and there's something going on right now. There's a fellow named Vivek Ramaswamy, or I'm sorry for, I don't remember the name, and I honestly don't care to remember it, to be frank. He's a Republican candidate who has surfaced for president. He speaks a lot of very nice things, but there's something wrong there. I don't know why. And the fact that he surfaced, I think he's a manifestation of kind of taking what Bobby Jindal, another person of Indian origin in America, a politician, it's like there was a lot of potential with him. And Bobby Jindal, if things had gone right, you know, in this country, Bobby Jindal would have made it to president of the United States. And he would have been a great president. And I'm talking about an Indian, a person born in America of Indian immigrants. So first generation American, I believe he was. I think his mother was pregnant with him when they came to America, if I remember correctly. So he wasn't even impregnated or conceived in America. He was conceived in India, if I have my story correct. And he came to America, and his political future got aborted when America went into delay mode. And it's as if this Vivek came and grabbed some of that and is using it. But there's something wrong there. And I believe that I haven't kept up for some reason with who the PM in Britain is. I don't know why ever since, you know, the Boris Johnson fiasco. It's like, I don't care too much. So I'm not sure who is who now, but I believe that the PM in Britain right now is of Indian origin. And that there's something there. So they are the next big roadblock to the releasing of greatness in the world. I don't know. I don't know why I'm saying this, but there's something to be worried about. India, the Indian culture, the Indian value system, and the Indian people as a group, not as individuals. If you're Indian, you're your own person. You're not tied to all, you know, what the other 1.whatever billion Indians on earth do. You're your own individual, your own values. So what I'm saying does not apply to you necessarily, unless you embrace those values. But that is like the big roadblock. And we'll talk about that later. But I know I've had this strong urge to mention that here. So now we'll finally, after this short intro, we're going to start talking about the 1876 election. And the 1876 election I'm reading here from the, or I'll be reading parts of some articles here on Wikipedia. I'm reading the article called 1876 United States Presidential Elections. It says that it was the 23rd quadrennial, which I think means every 4 years, presidential election held on Tuesday, November 7th, 1876, in which Republican nominee Rutherford B. Hayes faced Democrat Samuel Tilden. And just as a side note, I kept calling him Charles Tilden in other audio recordings. Not sure why. But I realized until a few hours ago, his name is Samuel Tilden. I kept looking at his articles and reading about him, and I just kept seeing Charles Tilden. I don't know why, until I realized, oh, his name was Samuel Tilden. So maybe there was something Charles-y about him. I don't know. Or maybe it's just my head. So I'm going to read here. It was one of the most contentious presidential elections in American history. Its resolution involved negotiations between the Republicans and Democrats, resulting in the Compromise of 1877. And on March 2nd, 1877, the counting of electoral votes by the House and Senate occurred, confirming Hayes as president. It was the second of five U.S. presidential elections in which the winner did not win a plurality of the national popular vote, but it was the first time since 1824. So what happened was that at that time, in 1876, the sitting president was Ulysses S. Grant. And out there say he was one of the greatest presidents in American history, flawed as he was, because he made many mistakes. And we have briefly talked about that before. But the thing is that a lot of people thought he was going to run for a third term, because that was his second term. He won in 1868 and won again in 1872. And they thought he was going to run in 1876, and people were urging him to run. But he said he wouldn't because he wanted to respect that two-term limit thing, that tradition that George Washington started. You know, because George Washington won the first two elections, but he didn't run for a third term because he didn't want the country to become dependent on him. He wanted the transition of power and that, you know, manifestation of a democracy. You know, he wanted to get the ball rolling, so he very selflessly withdrew. And that started this tradition that people would not run for more than two terms. And Grant said no, even though the country was just coming out of the Civil War and needed, you know, a strong leadership, and there could have been a lot of justifications for trying a third term, but he decided, and I really don't know, I think about it, I'm not sure if that was the right decision or not, I don't know, but the thing is that I understand his point of view, and I do appreciate it, that he chose to not run, and because he didn't run, then it, like, left this, you know, vacuum, you know, who's going to be president now. Because there were not too many great candidates out there, you could say. So that started the, you know, the race to see who could get nominated on each party. On the Republican side, it was kind of very difficult because at the beginning, there was this guy called James Blaine. He, at the beginning of the Republican National Convention, he seemed to be like the clear favorite to win. He was a fellow from Ohio. And it says here, on the first ballot, Blaine was just 100 votes short of a majority. His vote began to slide after the second ballot. However, as many Republicans feared that Blaine could not win the general election, anti-Blaine delegates could not agree on a candidate until his total rose to 41% on the sixth ballot. So they kept voting and voting and voting, but they couldn't get a majority. So he kept getting most of the votes, but not enough to clear the 50% plus one mark, you could say. Leaders of the Reform Republicans met privately and considered alternatives. They chose the reforming Ohio Governor Rutherford B. Hayes, who had been gradually building support during the convention until he finished second on the sixth ballot. On the seventh ballot, Hayes was nominated for president with 384 votes compared to 351 for Blaine and 21 for Benjamin Bristow. New York Representative William Wheeler was nominated for vice president by a much larger margin over his chief rival, Frederick Theodore Frelinghuysen. who later served as a member of the Electoral Commission, which awarded the election to Hayes. But so we wanted to talk briefly about this James G. Blaine, who could have been the Republican nominee in 1876, but for some reason he just couldn't get over the hump. And this man, he was born in Western Pennsylvania, but his family moved to Maine, or he moved to Maine after completing a college, and he became a newspaper editor. And that's interesting because Maine is where Hannibal Hamlin came from, and Hannibal Hamlin was the vice president during Lincoln's first term. And we've talked about him before. He should have been the 17th president of the United States, but son of a bitch Lincoln, being this compromising bastard and worthless son of a bitch that he was, decided to embrace Andrew Johnson as his vice president, a Democrat with Southern sympathies. And we've explained before why he did that, stupid idiot. So when he got his brains blown out, deservedly so, then Andrew Johnson took over and he did all this destructive stonewalling, blocking the Reconstruction process, blocking the radical Republicans, and making sure that black people wouldn't have the equality and freedom. So Maine was very influential in American politics for a while, and Hannibal Hamlin was from Maine. And it's interesting that this man kind of, it's as if you could say, in a sense, he took part of that impartation that was on Maine, that on Hannibal Hamlin, and he took it, and that's why he became influential. One thing that I wanted to mention about him was that when I'm not relying on a reliable source, but if I look at the Wikipedia article on James G. Blaine and I look up the word slave, the number of results are zero. And that is astounding if you think about it. Because if he was... So in other words, if, you know, and this sounds strange to say, sounds like I'm saying something very stupid, but if the Wikipedia editors didn't even find the need to type the word slave as they were writing out the article on James G. Blaine, it almost says, it kind of is an indicator of how much James G. Blaine himself had to say about slavery and the freeing of black Americans in the South and in the entire country. But so that is kind of a sad. And the weird thing is he was called the Magnetic Man. That was his nickname, Magnetic Man. I don't know if it was because, you know, metal would stick to him or something when he walked by, walked past metal or whatever. But apparently it had to do with him being a charismatic speaker. So he apparently had great oratory. And in other words, he could stir a crowd. I'm not sure how good he was, but apparently he was good enough to be the Magnetic Man. It's sad that that he, you know, didn't use that fire, you could say, that Nelsonic quality to galvanize the country around giving people freedom to black American and finishing the job that was started with the Civil War and the death of 600,000 Americans. And just as that, right after the paragraph on Wikipedia where they talk about him being the Magnetic Man, it says here, he began his political career as an early supporter of Republican Abraham Lincoln in the Union War effort in the American Civil War during Reconstruction. Blaine was a supporter of black suffrage, but opposed some of the more coercive measures of the radical Republicans. So in other words, that he was for people, black people being allowed to vote and black people being given freedom, but he was like, oh, we can't go too far, you know, like, oh, let's not be too radical about it, let's not, you know, because he wasn't for the quote more coercive measures of the radical Republicans, because the radical Republicans did understand the South was a defeated enemy, and we had to have our boot, our Yankee boot, on the southern neck until the southern neck said, "Yes, I will comply." And apparently Blaine was not of that thinking. So he was not. So in other words, what I'm trying to say is that he was not that great of a choice to begin with. And then Rutherford B. Hayes, if you go to his Wikipedia article, he was from Ohio. He was governor of Ohio, actually, for a time. And it says here, before the American Civil War, Hayes was a lawyer and staunch abolitionist who defended refugee slaves in court proceedings. He served in the Union Army and the House of Representatives before assuming the presidency. His presidency represents a turning point in U.S. history, as historians consider it the formal end of Reconstruction. Hayes, a prominent member of the Republican half-breed faction, and that long explanation of what half-breed is, it has to do with civil service reform and all that stuff, if I'm not mistaken. The thing is that he was a member of the half-breed faction. He placated both Southern Democrats and Whiggish Republican businessmen by ending the federal government's involvement in attempting to bring racial equality in the South. So so he started as a fervent man opposed to the oppression of black people, but it's as if he slowly lost that, to quote the Righteous Brothers, he lost that loving feeling. And I think he lost it just in time to become president. And this thing about the half-breed and civil service reform, that's a topic for another audio recording. That's another thing that has led to so many problems now. And on the surface, their campaign was noble. It looks noble or like a good thing, but it has caused so many problems because it was done on top of a messed up, crappy constitution. If it had been done in a proper way, in the proper context, then it would have been wonderful. But when you add, it's like, you can have this great, great must, a barbecue sauce, awesome sauce, like literally awesome sauce, like when people say that, oh, awesome sauce. So you can have this excellent barbecue sauce. And I'm sorry for being so graphic, but if you pour it on turds, it may change the taste a bit, but you're still eating turd. And that's kind of what this civil service reform movement did to the government, because it was sauced poured on top of a turdy constitutional system. And it has led to so many problems to this day. It is amazing, amazing, amazing. Amazingly sad, amazing in a bad way. But the thing is that, he was very focused on that nonsense, and not realizing that he had to focus on the bigger picture, the bigger problem in America was, resolving, finalizing what had been started with the Civil War and the sacrifice of 600,000 men, which was basically, it's as if we decided that half of those deaths don't count. So we had this half-hearted victory and we didn't finish the job. It is such a horrible, horrible way to waste such tremendous sacrifice. So now the thing is that Rutherford B. Hayes was able to win over James G. Blaine. And who knows what would have happened to Blaine had he become president, if something would have, being the great orator that he was, maybe he would have stirred things up or something would have happened within him. Who knows? We'll never know. At least in this realm, shall we say. But the thing is that Rutherford B. Hayes was able to win And as you can see, that, you know, the fact that they had to vote seven times until Rutherford B. Hayes came from behind like a horse in the race, you know, coming from behind to win, just showed you that there really wasn't much to cheer for. You know, people didn't know what to do. So Ulysses S. Grant, when he withdrew from seeking that third term, kind of left this vacuum. And I commend him. I still commend him for doing that. But I still wonder sometimes, should he have tried going for a third term? I don't know. But maybe the country just, he was, his withdrawing and then these two kind of half-hearted people coming up, maybe it was more a reflection of where the country was. And the country had become half-hearted. And maybe that's what was being reflected, you know, in that whole thing. But the thing is, Rutherford B. Hayes won the Republican nomination, and on the Democrat side, it was much easier, apparently. And this fellow named Samuel Tilden won. And he's kind of an interesting fellow. He was a, I'm reading from the Wikipedia article. He was born in 1814 into a wealthy family in New Lebanon, New York. Attracted to politics at a young age, he became a protege of Martin Van Buren. And he began, you know, he studied at Yale and became a lawyer and had this legal career in New York City. And it says he served in the New York State Assembly and helped launch Van Buren's candidacy in the 1848 presidential election. He opposed Abraham Lincoln in the 1860 presidential election. So from what I'm reading here, apparently he was the candidate it says he opposed Abraham Lincoln in the 1860 presidential election. In other words, in 1860, when Lincoln got elected, Tilden was an outspoken, apparently, enemy or opponent of Abraham Lincoln being nominated or winning the presidency. And then it says here, Tilden supported the Union during the American Civil War. So that means that that even though he was a Democrat, but he was a Northern Democrat from New York, he decided to support the Union and nominally Abraham Lincoln. And afterward, it says here, he became the chairman of the New York State Democratic Committee and managed Horatio Seymour's campaign in the 1868 presidential election. So one thing I wanted to read about him, if I can find it, is that if you look up the word slave on his Wikipedia page, you find it six times as opposed to James G. Blaine. So it says here, Tilden was a leader of the Barn Burners, an anti-slavery faction of the New York Democratic Party that arose during the debate over the Wilmot Proviso. And that's a proviso from 1850, I think it was, or 1846. I think we briefly talked about that in a previous article, very briefly. But the thing is that he was from the anti-slavery faction of the New York Democrat Party. And it says here, like other barn burners, Tilden sought to prevent the spread of slavery into the land acquired from Mexico in the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. He helped organize the 1848 Free Soil Convention, which nominated Van Buren for president. Van Buren's candidacy in the 1848 election, presidential election, drew votes from the from Democratic nominee Lewis Cass in New York, which played a role in the victory of Whig nominee Zachary Taylor. Like many other anti-slavery Democrats, Tilden did not join the Republican Party in the 1850s, but he did not have close relations with Democrat presidents Franklin Pierce and James Buchanan. In 1855, Tilden was the unsuccessful state attorney general candidate of the soft faction of barn burners, which favored compromise and reconciliation with the Democrat Party. In 1859, after he lost an election to serve as New York City's Corporation Counsel, Tilden announced he was out of politics, but then he came back. The thing is that he was anti-slavery. So he was a Democrat, but anti-slavery, but he started kind of like softening up. He was like, he didn't want to go all the way. Unlike other anti-slavery Democrats, it says here, he did not leave the Democratic Party and join the Republican Party. It's like saying, oh, you know, I'm staying. You know, it's like those Christians, when I hear about them, like, oh, they don't believe what their church preaches, but anymore, because they've had some sort of awakening or whatever, epiphany. So they don't believe a lot of this rubbish being indoctrinated in their churches, but they don't want to leave the church because it's part of their life. You know, it's part of who I am or whatever, you know, stupid things they say, or if God put me, if I was born into that church, that's where God wants me to be. You know, these very weird reasonings that they have. It's like an Israelite saying, hey, I was born in Egypt. Hence, this is where God wants me to be. You know, we were born slaves here in Egypt. Let's keep, you know, making clay, mixing clay with hay or whatever, to do all these bricks and all this stuff, because that's where God wants me to be. It's like talking to idiots. Pardon my frankness about that. But the thing is that this is kind of what Tilden was. You know, he was opposed to what his party was doing, but you know, he didn't want to leave the church, the Democrat Church. But at least he had the desire to end slavery, but he was more about compromise and reconciliation. That's what Tilden was about. Now, let me read very quickly what happened in the election. And it's interesting because on Wikipedia, the synopsis of what happened in the election is much clearer when you read it in the Samuel Tilden Wikipedia article than if you read it in the actual article about that election. So I'm just going to read from there, we'll try to get to the gist of it as quickly as possible, because time has flown by. So it says here, I'm reading from the post-election controversy section of the Samuel Tilden Wikipedia article. It says, with the election in doubt, each party sent some of their most prominent leaders to monitor the election process in the three disputed southern states. So what happened was, initial election returns showed that Hayes had carried South Carolina by several hundred votes. So again, we're talking about South Carolina, interestingly here. But that Tilden had won Florida by 91 votes and Louisiana by over 6,000 votes. So there were these three states, South Carolina, Florida, and Louisiana. And Hayes won South Carolina by a few hundred votes, and Tilden won the other two. You know, he won Florida by 91 votes. Just think about that. 91 votes. That's all he did. He won it by, supposedly. And Louisiana by over 6,000. But it says here, Republicans control the bodies charged with determining the validity of election results in all three states. On November 22nd, the South Carolina Canvassing Board adjourned after declaring that Hayes had won the state's electoral votes. On December 4th, the Louisiana Canvassing Board announced that it had thrown out 15,623 votes due to systemic intimidation, leaving Hayes as the winner of all the state's electoral votes. Early on the morning of December 6th, the Electoral College was scheduled to convene the Florida Canvassing Board. So, interesting. They hadn't decided, what was going to happen in Florida, and they were already going to have the electoral vote being done. But so the Florida Canvassing Board announced that Hayes had won the state by a margin of 924 votes. So it was went from 91 votes for Tilden to 924 for Hayes, the Republican. Democrats challenged the results in all three contested southern states. Meanwhile, another controversy had arisen in Oregon, where a Hayes elector, John Watts, resigned because his simultaneous service as a presidential elector and a low-ranking official in the post office violated the U.S. Constitution. After Watts resigned, the state's Democratic governor appointed an elector to fill the vacancy, while separately the state's two remaining Hayes electors chose a third elector to fill the vacancy caused by Watts' resignation. So you're seeing the mess that started happening. Now, the thing is, why was there controversy in Florida and Louisiana? Because in Florida and Louisiana, you know, part of the Deep South, throughout the South, there was a lot of voter intimidation, because they, you know, they talk about it now, and they it's so disgusting when Democrats use the term now, because it's a, when they bastardize the term, they delegitimize when it actually had a value. It's like, it's like when people compare everything to the Holocaust, and they don't, it's like all devaluing what happened in the Holocaust to Jews. It's an insult to a Jew to compare everything to the Holocaust, because they see it as, you're reducing the significance of what really happened there when you're equating things like that. So it's kind of the same thing when, or even worse, when Democrats claim black intimidation when there really wasn't any. But in those days, there really was, because you had the Klansmen, you had all these people, you had outright open racism, like overt, you can't question it. And they were making lots of efforts in the South to stop black voting because of Andrew Johnson, the damage Andrew Johnson had done. And Ulysses S. Grant did a lot to undo that, but it wasn't enough. So now, after 1874, that horrible election when the House, if I'm not mistaken, was taken by the Democrats, a mere less than 10 years after the Civil War, America turned its back on what had been done and said, we're going to go back to the past and put the Democrats in power. How disgusting. It was a horrible, horrible thing. And no coincidence that in 1974, we suffered the great shame of Nixon resigning to signify, the corruption of our system, in the decay of our system. We, in 1874, did a horrible thing. So when the Democrats saw that they were gaining momentum, they said, it inspired them to try to steal the 1876 election. So they started intimidating a lot of black people. So, and that's why Hayes only won by so few votes in South Carolina, because there was a lot of intimidation there. There was a lot of intimidation throughout the South, and it was enough in Florida and Louisiana to change the vote in favor of Tilden. And that's why the Republican legislatures there did the overturning. But see, that's the thing. Who has the authority to do that? Well, according to the Constitution, each state decides how to treat their own election process and how to elect their own electors. But that is also stupid, because there's no standard. So, the Republicans got lucky that they had control of those legislatures. And that's the problem. When you delegate all that voting process to the states, then you're allowing, whatever party controls the state at the time to decide things. And it's always going to be partisan, or most of the time. In this case, it was actually, doing the right thing, because the Democrats had stolen the election by preventing black people voting. But the fact that, these legislatures decide to do this, but there is no process. It's like, if there's something wrong with the election and people were not allowed to vote, you don't just say, okay, let's eliminate 15,000 votes the way they did in Louisiana, for example. What you do is you do the election again. But since there's no process to do it, because there's nothing in our system to deal with contested elections, it's not there. And on top of that, we have a system of elitism, where the stupid founding fathers put this thing of the Electoral College. And the reason why they did it is, the argument, and all these people who worship at the feet of the founding fathers, they will say, oh, how brilliant and wise these men were, because they wanted to prevent demagoguery taking over the country and leading to people, being manipulated by emotions to do all these rash things. So, yes, we'll let these plebeians vote, but then we will, delegate the voting that actually counts to an elite group selected from each state. So each state legislature can be given the opportunity to correct the demagoguery or excessive impulses of these masses, of these plebeian masses who may have voted a certain way. So it's as if to say, hey, let's put a layer of protection. Let's put an elitist layer of protection. And that's what the Electoral College does. It starts muddying up things. And you say, oh, well, we wouldn't have had we would have had Al Gore as president in 2000 if it weren't for the Electoral College. The thing is, the Electoral College, the system promoted this isolation of states, where, you know, if a state is blue and you have no chance of winning it, you just don't campaign there. So obviously, then this creates these strongholds in these red states and blue states, and it's no reflection. So the actual popular vote is not a real reflection of who could have won in a system where there was no Electoral College. You see what I'm saying? The Electoral College kind of creates an environment that then justifies it, if you see what I'm trying to say. So the thing is, but it creates more problems than benefits. That's why we have this balkanized country now, where you have all these, you know, Florida, you know, all red and conservative, and then you have California and all these other places all blue and radical blue. And it's because of the Electoral College system, this elitism that the founding fathers stupidly put into the system. And then we have this problem here in this 1876 election of this elector who got nullified on a technicality. He resigned because he worked at the post office. Maybe he was like the guy who took your mail, you know, but technically under the Constitution, because the post office is part of the government, which is a stupidity in and of itself. And I could talk for hours about that. I despise the post office, the U.S. Postal Service. They're evil. It's an evil institution. There are a few decent people, you know, scattered amongst the thing, but as a whole, it's evil, evil. I despise the U.S. Postal Service. Evil. And interestingly, they had a lot to do with the stealing of the election in 2020. It's not a coincidence. So it's interesting that a postal office employee is involved here. But it's, you know, and they are arrogant. The Postal Service people, if you deal, that's why they're so rude to you when you go to the post office. They are so arrogant and rude because, oh, I'm government, you know. No, you carry mail. That's all you do. And you're not even in the budget, in the government budget. You have to finance yourselves. And yeah, the government lends you money with all these deficits, because the U.S. Postal Service is under a curse right now. And that's why they lose money and lose money and lose money. And they're a failure. And the government has to subsidize them. But they're not even in the budget. They're like half government, half not government. So the thing is that on a technicality, you know, stupid technicality, this elector had to resign, and then there's no procedure. So the governor appoints a Democrat governor appoints an elector, and obviously he's going to appoint a Democrat elector who's going to vote Democrat, and then the other two electors who didn't resign, who didn't have a reason to resign. And obviously they were going to vote for Hayes. They nominated or chose a third elector, but there was no clarity in who, you know, which elector do we take? The one that the other two chose or the one that the governor chose? It's all a mess. It's such a stupid system. So adding the elector thing just complicates things. It adds this layer of elitism. And the thing is, see, if the country wants to go crazy, wants to go evil, you know, be dominated by impulses and all this stuff, let's do it. You know, if the country wants to destroy itself, let it destroy itself. But let's not have this thing, because the problem is when you put all these stupid things, artificial things, to try to control the masses and all that, you destroy any capability of actual change, because sometimes the impulse is for something good. Sometimes you need a radical surge in order to have radical change done. And it's like slavery wouldn't go away. It never went away under the system that the founding fathers left. We had to go to war to have it finished. So and as I've said before, when we have all these artificial internal blockages, and that's kind of what we had, these internal blood clots that we have within the system, it prevents radical, you know, positive change happening, because you only do the minimum you can do. You know, we'll never have in America, there will never be, you know, balanced budgets again, because to do that requires a political sacrifice or political bravery that we cannot accomplish in the current system, because the current system does not allow for radical solutions. Everything, if somebody tries something radical to make the necessary radical change to fix things, there's going to be the other side who is given enough power to oppose it. So we have this system of all checks and balances and blah, blah. No, it's so poorly designed that these checks and balances prevent us ever doing the actual changes that need to be done. But if the country wants to destroy itself, let it destroy itself. It's going to destroy itself anyway. All you're doing is delaying the inevitable by instituting all these extra layers. We should have always had a national vote. But you know why the founding fathers didn't want to do that? Because democracy was too radical of a concept back in the 1700s to them to really do it that way. They wanted to be careful not to be, you know, too radical or you know, because they were coming on. Being weaned off of a monarchical system, and we take this as if this was the and conservatives always brag, oh, we are republic, not a democracy, and they say it with so much stupid pride they don't realize the stupidity of what they're saying. They believe in elitism. Elitism leads to all sorts of problems, and it's part of the matriarchal system. The matriarchal system that we briefly talked about is built in large part on elitism, on a caste system. And India, by the way, has a literal caste system. So maybe this is why India is there's something there. I don't know. But the thing is that elitism is a caste system, and the Electoral College is a manifestation of that. So the thing is that so this was the controversy, and so on December 6th, the members of the Electoral College, I'm reading again from the article from Samuel Tilden, the post-election controversy section. On December 6th, the members of the Electoral College met in Washington, D.C., but the disputes in four states prevented a conclusive vote for president. So four states. It was South Carolina, Florida, Louisiana, and Oregon, because of that one elector, the postal worker, who had to resign because postal workers are government and you can't be an elector if you're working for the government. Conflict of interest. Yeah, because, you know, he was carrying mail and that creates a conflict of interest. But the thing is that these four states had this controversy. So it says here, with the Electoral College unable to select a president, the disputed election became an issue for Congress to settle. Republicans controlled the Senate while Democrats controlled the House. The vague wording of the Constitution gave rise to further controversy. I'm reading from the article. This is not my word. So the editor of the article apparently agrees that, as you don't have to be a scientist or a conspiracy anti-constitution theorist to say this. The reality is the Constitution is vague, so vague about so many things. That's why we have so many problems. So it says here, the vague wording of the Constitution gave rise to further controversy. If Republicans held that Thomas W. Ferry, a Republican senator from Michigan, and the president pro tempore of the United States Senate, could determine the validity of the disputed electoral votes. Democrats argued that Ferry could only count the votes that were not disputed. In such a scenario, neither candidate would have an electoral vote majority, necessitating a contingent election in the United States House of Representatives. So we'll mention what the contingent election is. But since Democrats control the majority of the state delegations in the House, they would be able to elect Tilden as president in a contingent election. Why? Because of the 1874 election. America prostituted herself in 1874, voted for the Democrats, put them in the House, and that would have elected Tilden as president. So 1874 was so crucial in the death of the Republic because it enabled this whole controversy. So the Republicans knew that if they went into a contingent election process, they couldn't just give up and say, okay, we don't know, we can't do the electoral count thing, so let's go to the contingent election, which had happened before, because they had to change the system with the 12th Amendment, long story. Because the founding fathers put in a system, and after the second election, it started falling apart. It's the system where they had, that's too long to explain, but the Electoral College, every elector voted for president, vice president, but he didn't, no one said, this is the president and this is the vice president. So they just voted for two people, but they wouldn't say which one they wanted to be president. So that created all sorts of problems. Oh, long story. So they had to change the system to make that's how the 12th Amendment came in, and they changed it. So, but until they made the change, they had to have some contingent elections. So, it's like very early on, they found out, hey, there's something wrong here. They just tweaked it with the 12th Amendment to kind of make it workable. But the problem, the core metaphysical problem, remained in there. So the thing is that the Republicans view, if we go to a contingent election, Tilden becomes the winner. And that was the key. And why would he be the winner? Because America prostituted herself in 1874 and voted in the Democrats. 9 years after the Democrats had torn the country in two and were willing to kill themselves and kill other Americans to uphold the right to own slaves. So America elected these Democrats in 1874 that enabled this threat that they couldn't go to a contingent election, the Republicans knew, because if they did, the Democrats would win. So so in response to the controversy, it says here, Tilden compiled his own study of electoral procedures in the previous 22 presidential elections. And this was the 23rd election. And 23 is a very matriarchal number, so this is not a coincidence. Thanks. He delivered the study to every sitting member of Congress, but congressional Republicans were not swayed by Tilden's argument that history supported the Democratic position on the election returns. And to a certain extent, it did. The process supported the idea that, yeah, okay, we don't know who won in these states. Then the Constitution says we have to go to a contingent election. And that, so the procedure is correct. Tilden was correct. That was the way to go. But the problem is, if this is the way to go according to the Constitution, then we have a problem. It's like you have a map, like you have like a GPS thing, you know, in your car, and it says turn left or turn right. And you turn right, and it says keep going 200 meters ahead. And you're driving forward. And you see there's a cliff, you know, 50 meters away. But the GPS system, the lady says, keep going straight, 200 meters. And you go, you know, there's no 200 meters. It's only 50 meters, and then I fall off the cliff and die. So at that point, what do you do? You say, no, the GPS lady says, I have to keep going straight. And I know there's no 200 meters of road there. It's only 50 meters, and then there's a cliff, and then a 100-foot fall, and I'll die. And I will do this because the GPS lady says it. No, you stop the car and go, maybe GPS lady doesn't know what she's talking about. Maybe there was a road here, like back in the, you know, dinosaur era, but the road's not there anymore. So you have to, at that point, you start questioning GPS lady. In the same way, we should have said, okay, GPS Constitution, left by our wonderful founding fathers, is leading us down this very, very dark road. And we're going to go off the cliff. There's something wrong with the system. Because the system doesn't address the issue of electoral fraud. These wise men who are praised over and over and over again by their worshipers, these founding fathers, who supposedly knew how corrupt the human nature was, and that's why they put in all these wonderful checks and balances into our system, because that controlled this very evil human nature that they were so wisely aware of. These idiots didn't, these men who were so aware about the human condition, never considered the possibility of fraud, or just outright, let's say, maybe not fraud. Let's even think about, you know, human error, where there's a dispute, you know, ballots got lost because somebody, put out the trash and didn't realize, it was a whole bunch of ballots. They got thrown in the rubbish bin and never got voted on. Maybe not intentionally, you know, but it happened. So they never considered that. And they said, oh, the solution is for the elites in Congress to vote. So the hell with the what the plebeian masses actually wanted. Let's fix it in our way, and we'll, you know, maybe get it right the next time. But right now, we just want to get it over with, and let's have Congress vote, the elites in Congress. See this thing, the fear. They never let the actual people decide. They were able to decide the electors, but the electors were the ones who actually decided who won. And if the electors could not decide, then the House, you know, a legislative body would decide. No, not a single thought about, oh, let's take it back to the people. Let's redo this thing. Let's redo the election. None of that. So this elitism, and that's what makes us a republic, not a democracy. And, oh, we're so proud, really. So the thing is, Tillman was right. But the Republicans didn't want to hear it because they knew that if they followed more or less what the GPS Constitution was saying, they were going to lose. So he said, says here, Tilden continued to call for calm and rejected Abram Hewitt's suggestion that he ask his supporters to engage in mass public demonstrations. So the thing is that it was a mess. And maybe I could read more from here, but I think it's not worth it, and I don't think we can would be able to say everything that needs to be said. But suffice it to say that at the end of the day, the Democrats had a meeting with Hayes, and they said okay, because they knew they had cheated. And they said to Hayes, okay. We're going to let you win. We're going to give you Florida, Louisiana. I know you won South Carolina by a few hundred votes. It would have been by thousands of votes, but, you know, we didn't let those Negroes vote. So we know you would have won by a bigger margin in South Carolina. We know that those 91 votes in Florida by which Tilden won would have been blown away if we had really let all the Negroes vote. And same in Louisiana, and Oregon, you know, the thing about the elector and him being a postal worker, you know, it's like a technicality, we know, and it's not fair that, we know that's not fair, but okay, we're not going to win the moral battle here, but you know what, we're going to let you win, but you have to do one thing for us, because the only reason we really cared about this whole thing and electing Tilden, because Tilden was actually a Northern Democrat and a man who had been anti-slavery before he started softening up, but he was not really a pro-slavery, pro-South, and oppression of black people type of fellow. So they really didn't care too much for Tilden. Tilden was the best chance they had to win, and they just wanted to have a Democrat in power so that they could then, you know, do their thing unimpeded. Because Tilden was a soft person. He was if he had been president, he would have been like a softy with the South. Even though he was against the oppression of black people on principle, he would not have had the character to really go after them. And that's why they wanted him. But he really wasn't that exciting to them. You know, he was not, you know, I forget the name of it, Grand Wizard, you know, KKK Grand Wizard kind of material. So he was not that exciting to them. So I said, well, okay, we don't want Tilden, but the reason why we wanted Tilden to win is because we want to end Reconstruction. We want to end the involvement of the federal government in our affairs. Get the hell out of our state matters, state rights rule, baby. And if you let us be and you stop imposing all this black equal rights nonsense, then, you know, we'll be okay with you winning. And Hay said, right on, brother, right on. So he said, okay, that ends the problem. That ends this constitutional crisis. I get elected. We all win. And, well, everyone but black people. But I'm okay with that. The guy who had been a strong abolitionist sold his soul to the devil. Son of a bitch, Rutherford B. Hayes. If I could see him, I'd spit on his face. Son of a bitch, bastard boy. And when he decided to sell his soul to the devil, black people were done. And that's when Reconstruction ended. And that's when the KKK began to have its resurgence and discrimination. Then the South was free to put in all these Jim Crow laws and institutionalized repression of black votes and discrimination and white bathrooms and black bathrooms and all of this. So it all happened because at that moment in 1876, 100 years after 1776, we've said this so many times, 1776 should have been the day when the gradual end of slavery would have been, kind of made official. But we didn't do it. And then 100 years later, instead of learning our lesson, we just made it worse again. So again, we went into compromise. And the thing is that it says here, some Democrats urged Tilden to reject the results and take the presidential oath of office, but Tilden declined to do so. On March 3rd, the House passed a resolution declaring Tilden the duly elected president of the United States. So even then, the Democrats said, oh, we still want Tilden. But it says, but this had no legal effect. Tilden himself stated that, quote, I can retire to private life with the consciousness that I shall receive from posterity the credit of having been elected to the highest position in the gift of the people without any of the cares and responsibilities of the office, unquote. Tilden was the second individual after Andrew Jackson in 1824 to lose a presidential election despite winning at least a plurality of the popular vote. Tilden remains the only individual to lose a presidential election while winning an outright majority of the popular vote. And I wanted to mention here, I don't know if I can find it, but this guy broke records. I mean, statistically speaking, because he's the only person who's gotten the majority, statistically speaking, because remember, black vote was suppressed, but he statistically got the majority of the popular vote and didn't win. And on top of that, that election, I don't know where to find it right now, but I hope I'm not too off, but I vaguely recall that the participation in that election was huge, the highest in American history in 1876. And I could be wrong on the exact number, but I think it was around 88% of people eligible to vote, voting, 88%. I mean, it was like everybody knew how significant that election was. And if you do the, I forget the exact, the official term, but if you, there's a term where they, what they do is they take the percentage of popular vote multiplied by the percentage eligible people who voted. And that gives you like a combined percentage of, the actual people in the country who voted for you. And Tilden has the highest number in American election history. Samuel Tilden, whom I kept calling Charles Tilden. And I think there's a reason for that. Because Samuel, represents, like if you go to the, you're a conservative Christian, you go to the Bible and you read about Samuel, he was a guy who was, he was a person who was willing to change things. He was not committed to things. In the Bible, it says that Saul was rejected as king, and he really loved Saul. And it says in the Bible that God told him, hey, stop crying for Saul. Go anoint David as the king. And he went and anointed David as the king. It kind of makes me think about a conservative who's crying over his constitution and the founding fathers and being told, hey, forget about it. It's not worth crying over that. There's something new awaiting you, a new paradigm to embrace. Go embrace it. That's what Samuel, the name Samuel, represents in my head. And I don't think this guy was a Samuel. And that's why I think he was more of a Charles, you know, like the turd in England right now. That's supposedly the quote, you know, monarch, but he really isn't. There is no king of England anymore, as we've said before. But I do want to read one thing. It's just I just found it amusing when I was looking for information on Tilden. I found this website. It's ushistory.com, but it's with two hyphens, u-s-history.com. And they have a page on Samuel Tilden, and it says his schooling was, I'm reading from that short paragraph, short page on him. His schooling was sporadic on account of his chronic ill health, a condition that would plague him for the remainder of his life. So he had some sort of physical condition that kind of weakened him, I think. He says he later attended Yale and the University of the City of New York, but did not graduate. Tilden studied the law and was admitted to the bar in 1841. His practice prospered primarily from work he did for the major railroads. His considerable fees were invested in real estate, enabling him to become wealthy at an early age. Okay, so then it keeps reading and all that. Tilden was a supporter of the Union effort in the Civil War, but was critical of Abraham Lincoln and the development of an increasingly strong central government. He was later an opponent of radical Reconstruction. Following the war, Tilden played a leading role in the reorganization of the Democratic Party in New York State and came to national attention through his efforts to throw out the corrupt Tweed Ring. Tweed as in Shannon Tweed. Tweed Ring. But not Shannon. I don't think she was involved there. His image was further enhanced by destroying the canal ring. A group of dishonest New Yorkers of both parties who had profited immensely from bogus canal maintenance schemes. So he was kind of anti-corruption, all that. So they talk about him accepting the result of the 1876 election and telling people not to contest it. Tilden was approached again by the Democrats in 1880 and 1884, you know, the next two elections, but he refused to consider another nomination. And a portion of Tilden's fortune was left for the creation of a free public library. That bequest was merged with others in 1895 to establish the New York Public Library. And I did not know that. So when I walked by the New York, you know, library, the central one on Fifth Avenue, almost practically every week. So Tilden had a lot to do with that. I don't know what to make of that. Samuel J. Tilden was a strange mixture for a politician. He was not an imposing man, tending to be nervous, small voice, and almost timid. However, he overshadowed those qualities through intelligence and a strong sense of organization. Tilden was respected, not loved, by the voters. A number of historians have suggested that a more forceful figure would have managed to shame the Republicans out of their successful effort to steal the election in 1877. I find this so laughable, because when I read that, I chuckled out loud, I think, because I went to the about section of this website, and it's from Portland, from Oregon, someplace in Oregon, and Oregon has some conservative sections, but I would dare, it's mostly, you know, liberal hellhole, and so I would dare say these are Democrats who wrote this rubbish. Who write on this website, and it's so interesting how these Democrats who claim to care for black people, you know, and they don't point out the fact that the Democrats were the ones who stole the election. Yeah, technically, maybe Tilden won, technically, because, you know, if you count the votes, you know, there were more votes for him than the other guy. But the problem is there were more votes for Tilden, because all the black folk who wanted to vote for Hayes were not allowed to vote by the racist Democrats. That's why, you know. So who really stole the election? Who really wanted to steal the election? It was the Democrats. But they don't point, and the reason why they say it like that is like a jab at the people who contest, you know, who question the 2020 election. That's why they wrote that rubbish there. And I say, what a bunch of hypocrites. They claim to care about black people. They talk about, you know, Republicans want to suppress black voting, and through demanding photo IDs. That's so racist and all that. They speak all this, and you know, when they when they expose what's in their heart, they show they are hypocrites. They really don't give a damn about black people. It's all emotion. Oh yeah, I care about black people. No, but when push comes to shove, they care about their ideology, their agenda. And they care more about the Democrat Party than about black people. It's just the reality. And if they had to choose between the black people and the Democrat Party, the Democrat Party is always going to win because that's their idol. Their ideology is their God and their religion. They're religious fanatics. They're crazy religious fanatics. And their religion is liberalism. But the thing is, I wanted to mention here also is that Tilden was an organizer. So he was, that from that feminine personality thing that we've talked about, there are three male personalities and two female personalities. That's why he was soft-spoken and almost timid, not an imposing man, but very intelligent. So, and it's interesting that his money is ended up being used for the New York Public Library, you know, because organizers end up a lot of times becoming teachers. And, you know, yeah, a good library is a well-organized library where everything is, you know, in its right shelf and, you know, categorized correctly. That you have to be an organizer to love being in a library environment. So it's fitting that he was, you could say, behind the establishing of the New York Public Library in one way or another. So he was a female personality. So the matriarchy was blooming in 1876 and making a resurgence because the male personality, the radical Republicans, those who had this male willingness to fight and change things. When we say male, we're talking about in a figurative sense. You can be a female and still a physical female and still have a male drive in the sense that we're talking about. But at the end, it's like America said, no, we want to be female again. And they chose a teacher, a soft-spoken teacher, nice fellow, but, you know, he was not going to make any radical changes to help black people. Even though his heart may have been, you know, towards helping black people, he was not going to do much because he was a librarian, you know, figuratively speaking. And then you had the other, the son of a bitch compromiser, a server, a personality in Rutherford B. Hayes, who was willing to compromise and who was an opportunist. And he said, oh, I'll do more for the country if I compromise and just, you know, sell black people down the river, literally and figuratively, so that I can be president and kind of get some of the things I want done. So that happened 100 years after July 4th, 1776, more or less. Well, obviously this happened at the end of 1876 and into 1877, but it was 100 years after the birth of the nation. And that was a very sad election. And it kind of sealed what had been started by the prostitution of America in 1874. And it marked the end of the Republican Party in the sense of being a party that was there to fight for black people. And that party never came back to life ever. And that's in part why we are where we are. The Republican Party became the party of John Noble Darby. You know, the party of you know, we don't want to get too emotional, too furious or passionate about things. We just want to be this nobility that just laissez-faire everything, you know, just let it be, whisper words of wisdom, let it be. And that's all we're going to be. And the Democrats, they became the Nelsons, but Nelsons from the pits of hell, you know, the sons of fury and passion fighting, you know, windmills and fighting for all these false and destructive causes. And that's why America's about to die in a few weeks, and not too many weeks from now. This is the last 4th of July America will have as a first world nation with any promise of it being alive. Thank you for listening.